There's ways that we can restrict this. The reason to have the term limit thing is, first of all, there's the burnout issue. You know, what happens when cops go on and on? They get jaded, et cetera. There's the issue of development of rackets. I'm not sure how they would look in a participatory economy, but you could imagine that it might be the case that people who have power, direct power, they carry guns and whatnot, that they might develop certain understandings in communities that, you know, well, they get special attention, they get special services, they get this and that. We don't want that to happen. So we keep shifting them out before they have a chance, and there's less overlap between who's all cops at one time. So they can't develop these sorts of rackets that takes more than one person usually to do. Go ahead. Why don't you? Okay, the police association. Now, here's one of the hardest parts. Police, just like any other workers' council, will they have a right to organize as workers? To some extent, yeah. But we're going to treat policing just like we talked about when we introduced some of these special institutions that fall in the political sphere. We're going to treat them differently. We're going to put more restrictions on what you can decide inside your workers' council. Well, certainly, who puts their desk where, you know, hours of work even maybe, and things like that, you know, all sorts of stuff like that should still be controlled by the workers. But how much of a product we want to produce when we're talking about cops, what does that mean? You know, that we're starting to get scary there. Mm-hmm. So, and also, yeah, but then back to the ability for them to unionize against the community, maybe. The community saying, hey, the police force is getting out of hands, and the police get to unionize against that? Probably not. So, yeah, there's another thing. We want to limit their ability to associate and unionize while respecting their right to organize as workers.
What about in other studies where, you know, as soon as you turn 18, you do 2 years of sort of military service, and then you're done or something like that. And
yeah.
Everybody goes through that, and that's a role of...
Yeah, no, because there's some people that we just wouldn't want to be cops. You know, I like the idea that they have to really want to do it and that we have to approve of them. Without that, we get, and not just people that shouldn't be cops because they're assholes, because there are still going to be assholes in this future society, right? This isn't utopia. There will be assholes. People who just aren't good at it. People who don't like it. Especially if half their job is a community service role. I don't want to just look at these as authoritarian people. We need to start looking at them as people who can offer something socially. So we want them to be good at that, too. So we don't want to assume that everybody should do it. One of the other arguments that's similar to that is just that why don't we just all do it sort of as part of, why don't we all get some kind of training and do it all the time, and then we would never need cops? Well, again, maybe we don't all want to. I shouldn't have to intervene in a murder in progress, right? That's kind of scary. Is it assumed that someone is going to do this? No, we should be able to call in specialists who have the training and the equipment and the ability to respond to these types of things.
I'm sure you've probably thought of it, but it kind of sounds like you're making the assumption that cops would just continue to be armed, and specifically just so with the equipment. I mean,
okay.
To me, that's one of the big differences there, is removing the weapons from it, which is going to minimize a lot of what happens.
Yeah, there's going to be two more components that we want to definitely look at. One is going to be, do we allow them to patrol? I can't, and I've studied a little bit of criminology and kind of, you know, trying to figure out if there's any value in trolling. And there does seem to be some. It does seem to be that a lot of crimes, in low-level crimes especially, are actually decreased by the presence of police, by the likelihood that you might get caught in the process. What we don't see is that the types of crimes that we're going to define in our future society, remembering that there's an assumption that you have to have an overwhelming majority of the people in favor of a law in order for it to be passed. So we're going to have the most extreme stuff outlawed, and that's the only stuff that police respond to. Now, do patrols limit rape and murder? We've seen almost no evidence that they do, assuming the police are really interested in looking for rape while they're out on patrol. But even if they were, these are crimes that don't necessarily just happen out, you know, in the open. So the value of the patrol isn't very much. Now, the risk of the patrol, the reason I'm concerned about it, is what has been proven is that there are many, many, many more cases of police violence and police abuse when there are regular patrols. The more patrolling of a neighborhood, the more instances of police abuse are going to arise. That's our danger. We don't want folks out there looking for something to do when what they do in that part of their role is act as authoritarians. Okay. Now the issue of the tools that they're allowed to use. I don't know. We'd have to figure out a way that we could actually manage crime. People need to, if they're going to have this role, and we're going to ask them to intervene in certain situations, they will need the tools required to do it. If there's a need for a tool, we might have to say, well, you get that tool, unless we can prove that just having that tool is so absolutely dangerous that it's never possible. And now this is where it's going to start sounding weird. What if the tools are limited to the ones they're using against our movements right now here in the U.S., these sub-lethal things? It's an option. When a cop uses a beanbag gun or a taser against someone who's about to kill a bunch of people, I actually prefer that they do that than that they shoot them. So I'm not saying that these weapons shouldn't exist. I'd prefer they not use them against people who aren't any threat to anybody else. But, you know, we need to be reasonable about this, and I might particularly hate these weapons, but at the same time, we might be able to find a valuable role for them. Go ahead.
I think it's important to look at what kind of things just the populace can have, to look at what the police can have. You have to do that.
Yeah.
Given how U.S. culture is, we're talking about a 90% thing to pass a law. I couldn't picture 90% of people saying they're allowed to have a gun. So are we talking about citizens being armed? And then we definitely have to be talking about cops being armed and the people who are there.
Yeah, I don't know how we would get rid of the guns anyway. That's not part of any vision that I can really imagine by a long stretch.
Well, I mean, education. That's today.
Yeah,
we couldn't get 90%, but we're talking hundreds of years, you know?
Yeah, well, over time, yeah.
And,
go ahead.
And we can educate out of the need for guns.
John, you're pressing me. I was going to say, like, I feel like we need to, be more open-minded about what we consider tools. I mean, one of the things that I've noticed in dealing with cops is, they have no training in fucking mediation,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're supposed to be, like, resolving conflicts. I mean, I feel like that is a major component of it because, you know, I would say one of our qualifications for cops would be, you know, using violence would be their absolute last fucking resort, you know? I mean, all other means of, you know, things
mm-hmm.
should be used, and one of those is communication, and I feel like, you know, the import of that, you know, we shouldn't ever let that.
Yeah. Now this brings up something that I think is kind of the perfect, it's perfect. The closure to this is, the problem is that, so we're going to train cops to be able to use the least, least amount of force is necessary. So they're always going to have to, by protocol. But the problem is, if we decide that they might be in a situation that's dangerous enough that they need a weapon, that they're going to have it with them. That's dangerous. We want them, but they're going to have to use their judgment, okay? Now, we might also have an additional set of protocols when we're talking about having emergency response. An emergency response system might include that. Now remember, we have to call in order to get a cop in the society. They're not just going to wander up because they're not allowed out there, especially not in that role of being, you know, able to use authority or force. Okay? Now, an emergency response system might have a protocol that says we don't send a cop for everything, or we don't send a cop first for everything. We send someone whose role is absolutely not to be coercive, and then they decide if a cop gets called. Okay, so there might be another whole other layer there to prevent that someone with that weapon is going to show up at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we need another layer to this. We are talking about a new society where we get to build whatever institutions we need. And one of those institutions might be not just, aside from the police department, or to complement it, or to sort of make it even less necessary, some responders who have exactly the skills that you're talking about. Mm-hmm.
This first person you send, you know, won't have the authority to make him stop. Well, you know, I think that's one of the things the police do, at least in this country, you know, that if their woman is being abused and the police comes, you know, even that person,
mm-hmm.
that authority, the man will stop, you know, because there is the risk that you're going to go to prison. Now, if you send somebody, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But the key thing to remember is... Mm-hmm. Maybe, but that's actually not true. Because of patrolling, and because of how difficult it is to maintain consistent patrols, sometimes patrolling causes slower response. It's actually just a fact. If I'm patrolling, but I'm on the other side of town, which is farther than the police station, then actually my response is going to be slower than if I came from the police station. So we have the potential to get people there faster with patrolling, but not necessarily. But the thing to keep in mind is what I'm saying is we develop protocols that a call comes into an emergency response center, 911, whatever it is. Those people decide based on what is described as being in progress who to send. Okay, if a cop comes, now let's say I lie and I say, well, let's say that our society has said, for domestic abuse, for actual ongoing, you know, physical abuse that's happening right now, we send a cop directly because we might learn that exactly what you're saying is true, that it requires someone who can show up and use force. Otherwise, what we have are these counselor type folks coming and just trying to intervene in in an abusive situation where they're not working. So with experience, we might learn that no, now we send a cop immediately. Okay, if a cop is brought to a situation where they don't belong, where the person calling described exaggerated the situation in order to get a cop, the cop isn't allowed to respond and has to actually or can only respond in the role of that sort of counselor type thing. There's lots of ways that we can patch these things. We're gonna, you know, these are a lot of the ways that we poke holes, but I thought of these things by just sort of going, how do we patch this up? So here's one of the visions that I'm more confident about. I've done a lot of thinking about police, and I hope that's kind of contributed to at least the belief that it's not the end of the world if we decide that we still need to make laws and we still need to enforce them. And now we're going to talk about the next two phases of what might happen in that situation. Actually, we have a little bit of time if people want to talk more about the cop thing. I think you do, Jonathan. Is that what I'm starting to get the impression of?
It's pointing out, like, I mean, the cases of abuse, the cases of crime, we're totally restructuring society to get rid of a lot of the reasons that people commit crimes. I mean, mainly equality and economic reasons. And our education system is going to be teaching people to think for themselves and independently and stuff like that. And so, I mean, overall, we're going to have less, and we're not going to eliminate it. I mean, there are still going to be pathological people. But that's an argument that I run up against a lot, and I'm sure a lot of other people do. It's just, we're still going to have people killing people. And, well, yeah, of course we are. But we're going to have less of it. We're going to have, we're going to have a much more intelligent society that is not worried about where they're going to eat and things like that. And those are... Yeah. Really key factors to stress to people when you talk about having a society with, a lower police presence. And,
right.
And the other thing, too, would be community officers. I mean, not one central police station, but, neighborhoods, there's a place they can respond.
Right, for a quicker response. Mm-hmm. And another neat thing that I brought up in a couple of the Political Vision 1 classes, but not in all of them, is that the other way that we have limited need for any of this type of stuff, for police, courts, etc., is that because it's so difficult to create a law, rather than push for a lot of laws that aren't going to be very popular, even though people are going to recognize that there's some need for some way to deal with these things, and in a couple classes we did discuss sort of disorderly conduct and that level of violation as being something that, well, I don't know, do we have a law against disorderly conduct so that cops come in and do it at any point? Even when it's not, it's just at the level of just people being loud and maybe shoving or pushing, but not violent. It's just, or disturbing the peace, I think, is, I kept using different terms for these things. But disturbing the peace is another one. People are just simply being too loud, people being obnoxious, whatever, while others are trying to sleep. Well, it's going to be so hard to get a law passed against that because people are concerned about the abuses of its enforcement. Not because people think, well, anybody should have a right to scream outside anybody's window that they want to. That it's going to that the focus of being able to solve these problems is going to shift from legislature to creating institutions that provide alternative ways of dealing with these things. Now, and the basic way of dealing with most of those types of problems is to create spaces where people can go and be loud at any hour, to create the facilities for that type of stuff. And additionally, other types of mediation and intervention methods and institutions it would be much easier to create those than it would be to get a law passed around this issue. So the encouragement is to always find the least coercive means, because finding the coercive means is very, very difficult. Go ahead.
It seems like when we're talking about the army and the intervention and the cops and the weapons and things, like, we're not totally in this new society. It's like we still have one foot in today. How can we not? It's all we know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, hard to imagine, like, why don't we just jump where there's the need for
Yeah, you know, what you're doing right now is exactly what I've spent the last 4 years doing on and off. And what, you know, the assumptions are tough. Is that what, I mean, is that what you're kind of getting at? Is like...
Yeah, like maybe we just don't need, like, guns, and it's just not... And, like, the intervention and, like...
Yeah,
you look at most of the, like, now, it is the U.S. that is...
Yeah.
But if we just...
The difficult thing about vision is that we need to prepare for the potential eventualities of a lot of things that would be messy, that would be very bad. So if we don't, when the time comes, we really don't need some of these institutions or some of these concerns aren't even relevant, then that's fine. But what we're not going to do is go out and argue these things, or even in our own consciousness, be able to really reasonably assume that none of these issues are going to come up, and that's why we have to grapple with them.
So can I go the other direction, like? Have the society instead of like talking about, like, why talk about the army and the cops now? Why don't we? It's like we're adjusting into a vision that isn't there yet. Like, we haven't.
Just for the sake of, I don't know, I think just for the sake of having vision. I don't know.
That's exactly what the Bolsheviks did, though. Like, we want to go here a lot. It's going to be a progress. So, therefore, we're going to have a managerial society. We're not going to have the workers run things right at first. It's going to take an eventual evolution to get to that place. But if you start with no classism, no sexism, no racism, you know, whatever, you start with the idea that these are going to be the norms that are going to create our institutions economically and politically, then immediately, you know, if that's what everybody accepts, okay, of course that's a big if, but if that's what everybody accepts, then there's going to be very little need for, especially if your model is so good that everybody else is going to want to follow suit, it's going to be very little need for armies and police. It's almost going to be.
But that doesn't mean it will happen. You know, everybody can agree, and then there's a lot of people out there that they're racist and they don't notice. And then, you know, I talk to them and they go, oh, well, I don't understand you. And then if you argue, well, you're being racist, you're not trying. No, I'm not. I just don't understand you.
But we're making an assumption that we're going from what we got now,
Bruce,
to a.
Yeah, I.
Ideal political participation.
Wait. Okay.
I was just going to talk about, because I was just thinking about tools and about how different societies that are much older than us manifest different kinds of tools and, like, the relationship that they have with their bodies and through, like, different kinds of defense, like martial arts, like using a stick or using a spear or using a blowgun, just depending on your body region and, like, the needs of those tools at that time, that culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, if we're going to stay with this way of thinking and this way of using our bodies every day, then the gun just completes an idea, like an instantaneous kind of gratification. And so I think that's manifested through this way of thinking that we have with managing society. And then also, I think there's some piece about why we have punishment as it is. It's just really some kind of spectacle. And if, I mean... that whole line of thinking of
Punishment is in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
We're going to talk a lot about punishment, actually. So so we'll pick up there. Absolutely. All right. So now I do want to move on a little bit. Now we've got our system of legislation, and we've defined that murder is against the law. We've got our system of response in our worst case scenario. We've got these police. They come in and they arrest this person who is accused of murder. Okay. And one thing that's interesting is that when I talk about police, I didn't do a lot of discussion around investigation. Forensics and all sorts of, you know, the science of policing is very interesting. I don't really understand it, and I'm not sure how much detail we can get in here. There would be police who were, again, elected, who would have to be able to conduct some kind of investigation and see if we even have a reason to believe that a particular individual or group or whatever might have committed a crime.
Could that be a separate institution, though?
It could be a separate institution.
It might be to separate the powers. So
yeah.
No collusion between different fraternity brothers.
Yeah, it might be. It might be another institution, elected people, who has to work collectively, that is accountable to the citizen, you know, to the public, that goes through and says, you know, okay, well, we examine evidence this and this way, and we share what we find, and we discuss it, and we kind of come to a collective agreement that this even needs to be raised to the public, and that this even needs to come out. We protect people's rights while they're being investigated that way. Instead of having people being paraded around in front of the media all the time and accused, we're going to take a much more careful approach to that sort of stuff.
But
jobs. So you're going to have these people function within other disempowered jobs and other economic institutions, right?
No, there's disempowered jobs in forensics. There's the guy who has to code data all day. I mean,
sure.
Yeah, there's crap jobs in every line of work.
Yes, it's not. Yeah.
But I guess like some are more empowered than others, so you have to cross, like have people doing functions in different economic institutions.
In some, yeah.
Which as a checks and balances thing, we might want to do with cops intentionally.
Well, which is why I'm saying that we set up different roles for the cops internally. So, yeah, with the maybe these detective-type folks are just cops who have this community service role in addition and who have term limits, et cetera. One thing that we're taking away, remember, in this society, we're taking away any kind of economic incentive for people to get convictions, okay? And this is going to be one of the biggest changes we're going to see in a second when we talk about courts, but in the case of police, too. You don't get praised for how many people you arrest, and you certainly don't get a raise for how many people you arrest, right? I think the more people you arrest, the more suspicion you come under in a radical society, just like pretty much in today's society, if we even knew what cops were doing the most arrests. Some communities, now in my neighborhood, if you talk to the black folks in my neighborhood, they can tell you all the cops, and they can tell you a pretty good approximation of how many arrests they've made this year. They know it really well. That's something they've paid attention to. That's a part of a culture that's being constantly and daily oppressed. But I don't see why the rest of us aren't trying to develop this consciousness. I've been fucked over by these same cops. And when I get fucked over by those cops, the folks in my neighborhood start going, oh yeah, who did it? And then when I tell them the name, they know all about this guy. You know, like, I was like, holy shit, you know everybody else that he screwed over? And they're like, hell yeah, I can name him if you want. You know, there's something that, these are a lot of the checks and balances that are going to come around naturally if we're going to have social change. And we're going to learn lessons from oppressed communities in order to be able to have any pretense of having liberated our own. So we've taken away the economic incentive from detectives, and I don't want to get too much into the investigations part, but now we've got somebody, and we're pretty damn sure that the detectives in whatever sort of institution or council we've decided gets to decide says, all right, we're pretty sure that this person committed that murder. We've got a lot of evidence. We've got a ton of evidence. They, of course, don't get to say that they did it. They just get to say that this person now has to stand trial. So now we're in the court system. Now we've got to find a way to deal with this. I've been thinking a lot about the court system because I've been thinking a lot about trying to prepare this talk. And what I see is that in principle, our court system is really amazing. I'm having trouble coming up with criticisms of most of the elements of our court system as it is structured. Not as how it's used, as it's structured. We've got this adversarial method of trying people. Go ahead.
We've just got one judge who's in control of so much. You know,
there are problems. But let's look at the positive elements that we might want to keep.
Jurisprudence is a really good idea, I think.
In what way?
Well, just that, you know, if someone is being accused of a crime, you know, it isn't just this one judge who, you know, may not live in that community, but it's the people from the community, you know, looking at the evidence. And I guess you do get into issues of if they're biased and maybe they have a grudge mm-hmm. against this person. But, I mean, I do feel like the idea of, you know, being tried by, you know, your peers is, I think that's, you know, not necessarily a bad idea.
Yeah, not only tried by, not only judged by your peers, but by 12 of them, or maybe we'll switch the numbers, you know, maybe if we want to make it even harder to convict somebody and protect somebody's liberty more, then we'll make it 20 or whatever, but they all have to agree that beyond a reasonable doubt, you did this thing.
Yeah.
Just to convict you, and this has nothing to do with punishment yet, but just to convict you, they all have to agree. You have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Kind of in the same vein, like, we would also have to deal with, like, now in our society, like, if a jury decides that they don't want to observe the law, they can, isn't there something like, you know,
yeah.
And so that would be something we would have to look at too.
Leeway within juries, it's an interesting idea. I mean, I don't. We can always find ways to make it more liberal. More libertarian. We can always find ways to make it harder to convict people. What we want to do is find a system that actually somehow finds balance and is able to say, okay, well, yes, this person did it. We're almost 100% positive that they did it. Beyond any reasonable doubt, we're certain that they did it, and we all are. Now we've got the judges. Here's another problem. We've got people who are legal experts, but I'm not so sure that even in our society where there's some semblance of election of judges and stuff, that just be, I mean, they're legal experts. They can prove that. They can pass the tests about the laws. They know how to look things up. But they're judging and they're using opinion. So more direct and more involved election of judges would be one thing. Possibly having multiple judges. We're having much fewer trials. So why not have a couple more judges on panel at each trial to add a little bit more of an element there, a little bit more of an element of maybe having another body that just sort of oversees, a body of elected people who just kind of oversees the process of a trial and makes sure that it looks over the shoulder of those judges. What would we think is the biggest problem with the court system today and the way people are run through it?
It's too easy.
Well, it's slow, but...
People involved in it, like if you're trying the court system, a lot of people have no idea of the way laws work.
You mean like jurors?
No, like if you're a defendant, you know, I know that like a lot of the problem is that, you know, maybe you don't even know what your rights are or what to ask for or
right.
What you're being tried for or why. I mean, that's a big problem.
Yeah, so not even knowing what your rights are and the way that you're allowed through the system, the, you know, what is at your fingertips as far as defense and all sorts of things like that. So yeah, that's a big one, I think, and that's something that we would need to guarantee against. But we could do this by writing things into policy, fairly simply. Go ahead.
The whole concept of the district attorney really bothers me. This guy who's out there, basically, you know, his job is to sit there and, you know, he didn't see what happened, just sit there and make fault constantly and try to dig under.
Right.
If you have the place of the attorney, I mean, basically trying to.
Technically, philosophically, in our legal system, what is the district attorney's job? What is the prosecutor's job?
To represent the people.
It's to represent the people, but it's actually to go about things fairly. It's actually to say, well, you know, it's actually to be able to draw a line and say, you know, we don't have enough evidence. We're not going to push this. It isn't to always, always, always vigorously advocate for the prosecution. It's to advocate for the public and to advocate for some semblance of truth or fairness, right? Now, this doesn't happen. Why doesn't this happen now?
They're concerned with winning.
They're concerned with winning, and why is that?
Because they want to keep their job.
They want to keep their job, and they want to move their job up. It's that economic incentive. It's that social incentive. We need a society where we don't say, hey, great job. I'm glad that you got 100 convictions this year compared to your 50 last year. You know, if you got a conviction, it's got to be because it was necessary. And we're certainly not going to, again, reward you monetarily or really any other way for, you know, increasing the number of convictions that you have. So we take that motive away.
I just wanted to say two things. One, to speak to that, like have the prosecutorial misconduct to actually have a real, you know, penalty, because now it's like, you know, a prosecutor can, you know,
okay,
be accused or found to be have not conducted the investigation or what have you in the right way, and then, you know, the next week they're just on another case.
Yep.
So is that, and then I wanted to speak to what Kendra was talking about, just as far as like legal knowledge, and we were talking about judges and everything, and how we have like legal experts, and I think that, you know, one thing that we could address in the society would be to have all citizens have a baseline knowledge of the legal system, like, you know, what civics or something is supposed to be, like every, you know, people know what their rights are from, you know, very young age in our society. They know, you know, okay, if I get in this situation, whatever. So that's
what their opportunities are. Excellent.
And why couldn't you, when you pick a jury, just pick the DA and the judge for every single time?
Could possibly be. There's another way that we might really, really be able to get even more control, especially with the DA thing, I think. And even if it isn't every time, at least, you know, just to extend to the DA, this accountability, if you screw up, you don't get to do it again, but maybe even something bad happens. But also, you know, in order to get in that position in the first place, we have to choose you. I'm looking for something really big, though. What is the biggest frickin' problem with our system right now that is the reason that so damn many people are in prison right now?
Overload, and they push it through without really fairly representing a lot of people.
Yeah, but why?
We're prosecuting crimes that are stupid.
Well, it's racism and other sorts of identity biases. It's ageism, racism, sexism. All this shit is the reason that we've got this. What I'm trying to do is say, like, the system, the structure of the system needs some tinkering, but But I wouldn't want to leave here saying I'm not satisfied with the tinkering that we're proposing here, because how does, you know, it still doesn't compare to this terrible, massive amounts of injustice that are going on now. I mean, it's huge right now. But we're talking about transformations in these other spheres, and I just want to remind us that that's going to be a major component in making these things a lot easier to do.
And we're quite obviously not talking about groups who have a vested interest in a prison-industrial complex,
right?
Which is of overwhelming significance,
so, yeah.
As well as the competence of defense attorneys being entirely contingent upon the wealth of the defendant.
Right. Nobody gains from having more prisoners in jail except if it's actually in reality going to play out in terms of us being more secure and safe. That's the only possible benefit that we've got to allow to be perceived by the system or by the people or by any actors in the system as far as the outcomes that we're looking for. Only benefit is our own common safety. Nobody makes too much money. Nobody, you know, no industries are really fostered, with any imperative to do it. So the last thing that we really need to talk about is, okay, I've been through this process. It's been, I've had an advocate, just like defense attorneys now, where, we've got better advocates. That's another thing that I almost was assuming, but, we got to mention that. We've got better advocacy. I know my rights better. It was much, much harder for them to just sort of railroad me, and they weren't able to do that, so I got a fair trial, and they had the bloody knife that they found in my hand while I was sleeping on top of the criminal, or I'm sorry, on top of the victim, and I had earlier that day said, I'm going to murder that person tonight, et cetera, et cetera. I'm absolutely guilty. I've absolutely done it. Now what? What do we... Yeah, so, okay, so our instant... What we want to do is I think, focus as little on this notion of punishment in this, as much on this notion of corrections in an honest sense of that term as possible. That's the general approach that we want to take to this sort of punitive function. Now, we need to discuss what's a difficult philosophical issue, which is that concept of punishment. What gives us... Where do we get off punishing? Do you have a comment on that?
You're just assuming that if people it's just a deterrent. The idea that other people will be deterred if they realize there is a punishment if they do.
Yeah.
Which is a real force?
It's not
a very effective force. I'm probably going to interject a little bit of psychology. Psychology, like, especially the capital punishment specifically, people recognize things immediately. It's like the whole, you push a button, you get shocked. That's why you learn your lesson. But if you push the button and you get shocked 5 minutes later, it doesn't stay as well. So you know that there's a punishment, but you're able to rationalize around that. Unless you know that if you killed someone and you knew that as soon as that some lightning bolt was going to strike and you were going to die, you wouldn't kill somebody because you know it's a mutually assured destruction. You know what's going to happen if you do that. But someone just as easily can say, well, if I stab this guy and the cops are down the street, I can break and I might make it away. Then there's that's the same difference.
See, now the difference with capital punishment is that, as far as I've read, the little I've read and to do with this, is that what's a deterrent isn't the severity of punishment that you get if you get caught, but the certainty of getting caught. So the idea is definitely stupid, because all it does is raise the severity, and it's like, I'm going to be in jail. If they think they're going to go to jail, they're not going to do it the first place.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be about the death penalty. It could be stealing.
Well, okay, all right, but something needs to happen. Do you want to keep talking, or...? Something needs to happen as a result, right? I mean, and there is a deterrent factor in just knowing that something's going to happen, even if it isn't considered punishment. What we need to do is manage for our own security, right? Now let's say we've got someone who's... Now, the murderer is a tough one. If it was a random murder and we don't know who this person might kill next, first of all, we need a way to figure out what is the actual likelihood. They've gone through this whole system and we've determined that they did this thing. Now we need somebody, and it shouldn't just be the jury that went through the trial. It should be some other group of people who have some relevant expertise, but also an interest in being able to come to the proper, to the best, the most agreeable solution to what to do with this person. Okay, so we're going to look at it. Now let's say a body of six people who are not only experts and have some kind of expertise in the field of psychology, sociology, human behavior, but who are also elected and represent the people. Six of them are convinced that this person is absolutely never going to kill somebody again, no matter what, for whatever reason, and I'm not sure what they would come up with, but they might. Now do we get to put this person in jail or put any other restrictions on them, especially if we've already decided that you don't punish people? Maybe.
Do you think social science is to that point where...
No, where we could be sure that they're not going to? No, but is our court system, is our justice system ever going to be to the point where we can justify putting people away when we have no reason to believe they're ever going to do this again?
I think maybe.
They did it in the past. If we put them away and there's no reason to believe whatsoever, and most people don't murder more than once. And I think that that's probably true about not just people who get caught. It's enough for what, though? It's
once either. Once you're dead, you're dead.
Right, but you're talking, you're just talking in terms of punishment, though. If all we can do...
If the cop is going to do it once and he's going to be out of the system, you know, how come this murder gets, you know what I'm trying to say?
Right. So is it enough to be able to say... Now, it's clear in our society, if you murder somebody, we're not going to have any choice but to put you somewhere where you can't do it again. Does that justify doing it? It may very well. I don't like the idea, but I think that what you're saying is actually what we might have to settle on, just like with the cop. I don't like the idea of punishment, and I don't want it to be considered punishment, but the fact is that you were warned beforehand. We absolutely know that you did it. And now we don't know what to do. We don't know if it's okay. We don't feel confident letting you out there again because you did it once, and we told you you couldn't.
And we're looking at like a woman whose husband's beating her, and she kills him to end it. You know, there's many, many things she could have tried or did try.
And that's exactly the kind of thing. It's a non-systemic crime. It wasn't because of any kind of persistent factor other than the fact that there was this exacerbation that was not her fault, and for some reason or another, she couldn't find any other way out of it. Now, hopefully, we won't have this problem because we'll have all these other institutions in society that this woman can turn to. But we can't say that it won't come up. We have to pretty much expect that it will. Now, does this woman go to jail for the rest of her life or for any period, and how would we decide that period? Even though, really, we have a pretty good certainty that the reason she did it was because of the person that she killed was this husband who was beating her. And we really don't think she's going to do it again. Maybe we don't let her get married again because those are the circumstances in which it happened. But we want to do the least coercive thing in order to ensure that it doesn't happen again. It's kind of goofy, but now let's think of the child molester. Now our committee can with an almost 100% certainty, possibly in a certain case, say, well, this person who's been convicted of serially molesting children will do it again. But also, to an almost certainty, they've probably never committed any other crime and never would. They'll commit this crime over and over again, but they won't hurt adults. And they won't do anything else to other children, but they definitely won't do anything wrong to adults. Now, how do we deal with this? It's going to be a punishment if we say that they can never interact with adults again. That's managing beyond what they actually did.
I think we have to look at a more macro... So we've ruled out the deterrent idea?
No, but there's some deterrent effect to this.
Like,
to knowing that if I molest children and I get caught, I'll never be able to encounter a child again.
But you're as good off as if you'd never. But the choice, but it's not worse than if you just never molested children. You know what I mean? You want it to be not cruel, but not a pleasant idea, so that people don't want to get themselves in that situation.
Right, but really we'd rather come up with all the other ways that we'd want to condition, if you will,
right,
people to not do this stuff. You know, I mean, give everybody all the other options and all the reasons to not do this. And who knows what kind of clever ideas we'd come up with for ways to actually have people not molest children, have ways for people to not rape. We've got a lot of progress in a lot of fields that are fairly just scientific, and social movements might not even have much say in, but somebody might come up and say, well, here's actually some tools for solutions. I have no idea what they would be, but really there might be something there. But anyway, so we're going to use all of that that's at our disposal, and now we've got this situation where the person is really not going to hurt anybody but children. They're probably going to hurt children again. We've got to do something about it. It's not the end of the world if we put them in some sort of prison that respects human rights, that respects their dignity. And it isn't really a punishment. It's just our way of saying this is the best way we have to manage you at this point. Okay, that's not the end of the world. But it is a punishment. We need to acknowledge that in what happens to societies that rely on punishment. What happens to our culture? What's going to happen to us and our mindset? Knowing that we live every day in a world where we punish people, where we play God, where we get into the realm of saying we have the right to do this or that to people, even though it's beyond what is absolutely necessary for the maintenance of peace in the society, or it might be beyond that. So these are issues, but I want to start thinking of terms, when we think of justice, I want us to start thinking of terms that are a little bit more creative than vengeance, that are a little bit more creative, but that still maintain security and still have that potential. Go ahead.
Just because it's painful, I don't necessarily think that it needs to be called punishment. I mean, the idea of protecting the rest of us from somebody may cause pain to that person, but that doesn't mean it's vengeance-based, does it?
No, it doesn't mean that it's vengeance based, but.
Or that it's painful. To me, that the word punishment involves the concept of vengeance.
Yeah, it does involve it, is what you're saying.
Yeah,
right. Well, I think so too. So, but if our punishments are excessive, if our management procedures are excessive beyond what's minimally needed to control something, then I do think it starts to slip into the realm of punishment. So that's why I'm not sure that we wouldn't have a situation where, okay, well, you're a child molester, that means you cannot have access to children anymore. It doesn't mean that you don't get a balanced job complex, and it doesn't mean that you can't interact with your wife, other adults, who you're not going to hurt and you never have. It's weird. It's weird to think about these things. But maybe that's what we do. You can still have a job. You can still have freedom of association to a great extent. We have to find some solution to keep you away from children. Maybe that means confining you to a space where children do not exist. So you still get to choose your job. You don't get to be the daycare worker anymore. But, right? But you do get to have some freedoms. It's a very libertarian way to look at things, and it's kind of a very frightening way to settle on looking at things.
There's lots of alternative sentencing to mass incarceration, and I mean something like that, where while this person is being kept from children, they're still allowed to do other things, but in conjunction with that is they're going to be involved in that rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to provide the opportunity for people to deal with stuff like that. And one of the good ways, and this kind of goes back to the whole court thing too, is the idea of wisdom counsels as opposed to judges, where you have members of the community that it's not one person that can make a decision, it's several people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one way to come up with these alternative sentencing. There's technology that can be used to punish someone, put them under arrest in a sense, and still not put them into a little cage and say, all right, you're stuck there forever.
Right. So we have informed and not mandatory and not universal sentencing type things. So the way we handle people is on a case-by-case basis, and hopefully revolutions in the various spheres, kinship and culture especially, have made it, and right, the elimination of class differences, have made it so that those judgments can be fair and equitable. We're going to rely on those other spheres. If we're going to have fairness in the political sphere, from the electoral system all the way over to the end of the judicial system, what we're going to need is help from the cultural and kinship spheres in a big way. If people of color ever expect, if we ever expect people of color to be treated fairly, if they expect to be treated fairly, there's going to be a lot of work on all of our part to make sure that that comes about. So that when we do leave things up to people's judgments, and the accountability of what you're thinking is really hard for us to judge after the fact, we're going to have to rely on having those people available to make those kinds of decisions. People whose minds have been changed, who have a new revolutionary and radical perspective consistent with these values that we're all saying we appreciate. Go ahead.
I was just thinking momentarily about playing God is like having power over someone's life, but if they willingly part of the social contract or whatever,
mm-hmm.
from their, that they give up that power over their life. Not their life, but their freedom.
Mm-hmm.
When they take someone's life.
Yep. And when we come back to the concept of social contract, there's a lot that's attractive to it, that I knew ahead of time, that this is what happens if you do this thing, but it goes back to sort of that deterrent thing where we go, well, at the moment, was I taking all that into account? Do I deserve to pay on that level because of something that I did in the moment? And those are things that I think are going to need to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. You know, how aware of the social contract, how conscious of the social contract was I when I did this thing? Is it fair to hold me to that contract, you know, given all the sorts of factors that might be involved in the types of crime that we're trying to mitigate against? All right, that's all I got. I hope you guys had fun. I did. This is really helpful, so I hope to see you in part 3. Time to go relax or do whatever.